hesitate. He threw a perfect strike, and the blockhouse burst into flame. While we all cheered, Joe maneuvered the cameras to catch the roaring inferno, then called the day's shoot a big success. The next shot was an exterior shot of the dugout dance hall between Jake and Kaylee Hollister, the delightful actress playing the movie version of Valentine. The interior scene had been shot earlier and is near an exact replica of the basement dance hall I described in Rocket Boys as possible. This was another scene that Joe kept shooting over and over until he'd nearly worn the extras out. For my part, I was pleased that the song the kids slow danced to was Tommy Edwards' It's All in the Game. It was the song that was actually played when my beloved Dorothy Plunk fell into my brother's arms and danced, her sweet head on his broad chest, while my heart broke into a million pieces. When I told Larry Franco that this was the song that I heard that night, his research showed that it hadn't been released until a few years after the Rocket Boys era. This forced me to do my own research. Happily, I discovered there was an earlier release of the song in the late 1950s. This is why that great old song is played in the movie. The exterior dugout scene was filmed on a back street in Oliver Springs, where an old gas station had been painted to look like our teen hangout. Joe had decided to film it in the dark, meaning that everything needed to be set up and ready to go early. All day, the crew worked to get everything in place. The Tennessee State Police set up roadblocks, but crowds of the curious still gathered as close as they could get to the action. A neon sign that blinked Owl's Nest, the diner that was over the dugout, failed, and there was a lot of scurrying around to fix it without success. Finally, Joe said it would be fixed in post-production, and the filming began. In the book, Valentine takes pity on Sonny and seduces him in the back seat of a car after the dance. The movie version was much cleaner. Valentine is the same age as Homer and just wants to be his girlfriend. After the heart-crushing scene inside the dugout, the script has Homer going outside to lean against the hood of a car, where he grapples with the reality of losing a girl he never had. Then Valentine follows him and looks soulfully into his eyes. There's virtually no dialogue, but Homer figures out maybe he's been wrong about Valentine. Joe shot the scene 5 or 6 times, which didn't seem to faze Jake and Kaylee at all. In fact, they seemed to enjoy doing a scene which had few lines but lots of body language. Each time they did it, their nonverbal communication seemed to get a little better. I would later learn that a sexually graphic scene was filmed between Jake and Kaylee but was discarded because test audiences didn't like it. If it could be found, my guess is the adult audience for the movie would love to see it as an outtake. The next few days were dedicated to filming Chris Cooper's scenes. Chris, who was playing my dad, had only a short time to spend on location because of another role he had for a movie titled American Beauty. I knew him from 2 previous movies, Matawan, the story of a union mine organizer, and Lone Star, in which he played a Texas sheriff. Poignantly, the last movie my dad had seen before his death was Matawan. Before Chris came to Tennessee, I'd spoken briefly with him over the phone about Dad, who he kept calling John, just as it was in the script. It wasn't his fault. He had the name wrong, of course, so I didn't correct him. Instead, I told him how proud Dad was to be in the profession of mining coal, and what Coalwood meant to him. He was not only the leader of the miners, but he was also the unofficial mayor of our little town. This intrigued Chris, and we discussed how my father resisted Colwood's demise and took it upon himself to keep his miners safe. Chris asked if I had anything of Dad's he might wear or keep with him during the filming, so I sent along a silver dollar Dad always kept in his pocket for luck, plus his wristwatch and his Masonic ring. On set, Chris always had those things with him. My mother, the great and now late Elsie Hickam, chose to visit on the day when Chris played an intense scene with Natalie. Before the shot, I brought Mom around to say hello. Chris stepped out of his trailer dressed in the same kind of khakis Dad preferred for his work clothes. After I introduced him to Mom, he grinned and stuck out his hand to shake hers. When she saw he was wearing Dad's wristwatch and ring, tears filled her eyes. And for one of the few times in her life, my mom was at a loss for words. To her delight, Chris took Dad's silver dollar from his pocket. "You look just like Homer," Mom said. If this confused Chris, since he was playing John Hickam, he didn't let on. Instead, he promised her he would do his best to play her husband. Well, Mom said, back on solid ground, all he cared about was that old coal mine. Yes, ma'am, Chris said. I'll remember that. It was a cold day, so I gave Mom my NASA jacket so she could watch the scene being filmed on the Petros set. The crew rushed over a chair for her, and there she perched, queen for the day. The wonderful actor Randy Stripling, who was playing the machinist Leon Bolden, the man who taught the Rocket Boys how to operate a lathe and build their rockets, came over to say hello. I'm Leon Bolden, the machinist, he said with a big grin. Mom puzzled over him for a few seconds, then said, I'm sorry, I don't remember you. I rushed in to explain. Look, Mom, there's the book reality, the movie reality, and the real reality. Try not to get them mixed up. Mom gave me a warning look. I'd say that's more your problem, she snapped. And I knew it was time for me to back off. Next, Natalie came over for a word and a hug. Mom looked her over and said, I told Sonny I wanted Kathy Bates to play me, but I guess you'll do. Natalie didn't blink an eye. Kathy would have made a great you, she replied. Although Mom's remark to Natalie made me grit my teeth, it was just her way, and once they got past her directness, everybody loved her. While Joe set up the scene between Chris and Natalie, I allowed myself a moment to enjoy the Hollywood version of Colwood, noticing especially the sign that arched over the street that announced Olga Coal Company, Colwood, West Virginia. When the extras, dressed in grimy coveralls and miners' helmets, moved across the grounds, Colwood almost came alive. Mom didn't like Colwood because it had ultimately killed her husband, but I loved the old coal camp. It was, and forever will be, my home. The scene being shot after lunch was to show what happened in Colwood after my rocket display was stolen at the National Science Fair. In the book and in real life, I'd made my first long-distance telephone call ever, begging my mom to intercede in a bitter labor strike in Colwood so I could get more rockets built. In the scene Mom was about to watch, Natalie, as Elsie, strides through a crowd of angry, placard-waving miners to get to her husband's office, there to insist he settle the strike. While we waited, I went over to Natalie and apologized for Mom, but she laughed it off. That's a fine lady, your mom, she said. She stuck up for everything and everybody she loved. You, your father, all the Rocket Boys. I love playing her. Then she winked. And I'll do a better job than that old Kathy Bates, she'll see. When the time came, Natalie indeed showed the Elsie Hickam spirit, striding purposefully through hooting strikers to the company office. After a couple of takes, the cameras moved indoors to the office set. There, Natalie barged inside to tell John to settle the strike or she was going to leave him. When Chris asked where she would go, Natalie raised her chin and said, Myrtle Beach, then wheeled around and marched out the door. It was a bravado performance. Joe went to Natalie and uncharacteristically gave her a hug. Good job, he said while Natalie wiped away tears. Joe moved the cameras in for a close-up as Chris reacted to Natalie, his scowl dissolving into alternating pain, pride, and joy. Suddenly, Chris was my father, a man who tried desperately but sometimes clumsily to do the right thing for his mine, his town, and his family. Before the hushed gathering of filmmakers, Chris looked searchingly into his wife's eyes, begging for understanding. That was when I stopped watching. It was too real. When I looked around, I saw I wasn't the only one who'd been affected by Chris's performance. Larry was wiping his eyes and Chuck was taking deep breaths. Joe called a halt to the proceedings. Chris walked away from the set to be alone. Natalie went to her chair and bowed her head. For a few minutes, the hundreds of cast and crew and extras moved quietly, their conversations in hushed tones. Something magical had just happened, and everyone was trying to absorb it. Chapter 9. Linda and I were on hand for three more big scenes: the National Science Fair, the search for the lost rocket, and the launch of the Miss Riley, our last rocket. First came the fair. The set that was built was astonishingly accurate, even including other entries. I walked up and down the exhibits, amazed at the care taken to get every detail accurate. I had shared with Barry and the prop guys everything I recalled about my actual exhibit, and they had carefully recreated it. The first scene filmed was of Jake, Homer, explaining a rocket nozzle to onlookers. Naomi, Linda, and I stood together on a catwalk above the exhibits and watched him go through take after take, flubbing his lines each time. The lines in the screenplay had been lifted directly from the book. When rocket propellant is burned, it first produces a river of gas that flows into the convergence section of the nozzle. If the river continues through the throat at less than sonic speed, that is to say, less than the speed of sound, it becomes compacted in the divergent section, bound in turmoil, and inefficient. But if the gas reaches the speed of sound at the throat, then the gas in the divergent section goes supersonic. The problem with having those lines for Jake to say was they weren't meant as dialogue. They were made deliberately complex because it was what Quentin and I had concluded from the study of our rocket book. I wasn't certain if it was Lewis or Joe who had lifted them directly from the book, but there they were in all their tongue-twisting glory. When Jake finally gave up and asked for a minute to collect his thoughts, I decided to go downstairs and suggest a rewrite of the line, but before I could, Joe was pulled aside by the camera crew. The next take had the same result, and Jake was clearly getting flustered. Joe called for another break, but Jake asked to try it one more time. This time he got through it, except for one little stutter. Seeing how unsettled his actor was, Joe called a halt to the proceedings, promising to shoot it again later. He never did, and it was this last take that was used in the final edit. Interestingly, it would prove to be an endearing scene, the stutter seemingly caused by Homer being awestruck by being at the National Science Fair. When Linda's sister Elaine came to visit, we drove her out to a wooded site where a scene about the lost rocket was being filmed. In reality, we never lost a rocket, but I thought the way the scene was written made sense. The whole idea was to show the boys under stress, and then doing what it took to prove their innocence. After using the equation for range in Quentin's dilapidated house, Homer and Quentin go into the woods and find their rocket. The first thing I noticed when I arrived on location was the boys were using a rope to measure the distance from the launch pad to the lost rocket. This, of course, wouldn't work in real life, since according to the script, Quentin and Homer used trigonometry to calculate the distance, the result would be the length of a flat base of a triangle, in other words, a straight line. Using a rope to measure up and down hills would be hopelessly inaccurate. "Should I tell Joe or Larry?" I asked Linda. "No," she snapped. So I shrugged and let the scene play out. Interestingly, I've never heard a word from a trig teacher about it. Sometimes even trig teachers get immersed in a movie and forget reality, which is a testament, I suppose, to Joe's ability to put together a good story. The scene required Chris, Quentin, and Jake, Homer, unable to find their lost rocket, to come upon a stream. There Jake squats as if to get a drink of water. Pondering, he asks about the wind and which way it was blowing on the day the rocket was lost. A camera unit was downstream where a rocket mock-up had been stuck nose down in the water. That was where Joe and Fred had set up a special shot where Jake would be in focus and the rocket out of focus, but when Jake sees the rocket, it goes into focus and Jake blurs. It was a nice effect. Joe and Fred kept manipulating the camera until finally they were ready to go. Jake and Chris approached the stream and Joe said, "And action." Jake started his lines, then fumbled them. I thought he looked upset and wondered if the previous day's flubbed lines at the science fair had unnerved him a little. Take after take followed, and Jake just couldn't get them right. Finally, he shook his head and walked away while Chris, looking concerned, followed him. They had a few words, then Joe walked out to talk to them. They walked back, Joe to the camera, Chris settling into his spot, and Jake crouching by the stream. The camera rolled and the take was perfect. Jake caught my eye and I saw his relieved expression. I nodded to him and he grinned. One of the most important scenes in the movie is when the Rocket Boys thank Colwood for supporting them by hosting a final launch of their biggest and best rocket. It is also the day when my father finally shows up for a launch. An important scene in the movie, it was a pivotal one in the book. In fact, reliving that moment was the real reason why I'd written it, and I was concerned that it be portrayed honestly in the film. In Rocket Boys, the name of the rocket was AUK-XXXI. Before it was launched, other rockets were sent flying, each one better than the one before it. The crowd was huge, people coming from all over the county to honor the Rocket Boys for winning their medal. In my telling, I built tension leading up to the final launch by noting we had never tried to fire a rocket of those dimensions before, and we weren't completely certain if it would work. When my father unexpectedly showed up, I impulsively offered the rocket to Dad to launch, and the entire scene changed from a celebration to a very personal moment between a son and his father. Throughout the book, I not only craved the attention of my father, but his touch. At the final launch, I had hoped that Dad would put his arm around my shoulders and tell me I'd done something good. That would have been the payoff, and I knew the reader by then would be hoping for it. But I had to write it the way it happened, which, to my way of thinking, was better, because it was a surprise to everyone. After the rocket is launched, I wrote what happened this way. I was astonished to see Dad prancing along the slack, waving his old hat in his hand. He was exulting to the sky. Beautiful, beautiful! People surged from the road across the slack, following the other boys as they raced after our last great rocket. Dad stopped his dance and put his hat over his heart. He bent over, as if a great weight had suddenly been dropped on his back. He looked at me, his mouth open, and I saw in his eyes a curious mixture of happiness and pain that dissolved into fear. I went to him and put my arm around his shoulder, supporting him, while he fought for air. "You did really good, Dad," I told him as a spasm of deep, oily coughs racked his body. "Nobody ever launched a better rocket than you." Although I knew he was under a lot of pressure to wrap things up, I still went to Joe to discuss the way I had described the day in my memoir versus what was in the script. Lewis had condensed everything to just one rocket named Miss Riley, and during its flight the father was to proudly put his arm around the boy. I liked the rocket's new name, but I thought my way, the son supporting the father in an ironic twist, was better than what was in the script. Joe heard me out, then said, "I think we'll film it my way, Homer." And that was that. In some ways, the filming of the final launch was as thrilling as the real one, back in Colwood in 1960. I could tell the extras were pumped up, as were Jake and the boys. This was the climactic moment of the entire movie. Joey D and his team had prepared several Miss Rileys, big rockets designed by Kai Michelson, the famous rocket builder. I had 100% confidence they would work. Joey D gave me the honor of launching all of these last rockets. They flew perfectly, although I noticed a mild instability at liftoff, probably caused by the addition of a fake external nozzle. With the rocket launches in the can, what had been a lovely day turned sour, with the wind picking up and low clouds packing in overhead. When somebody yelled, "Tornado!" I saw a swirl of gray air drop from the clouds and start dancing along the edge of the slack. People started running while Chuck, Linda, and I sought shelter beneath a canvas canopy meant to protect the cameras. Another whirlwind appeared, turned black from the coal that was sucking up inside its guts, and hurtled toward us. With nowhere to run, we grabbed the spars of the canopy and held on, even when we were lifted a foot off the ground. Fortunately, as soon as they had appeared, the mini-tornadoes vanished. We were dropped back to earth, the clouds scudded away, and the sun came out. I heard Joe reorganizing his crew. Chuck, Linda, and I looked at each other and shook our heads. Without a break, the filming continued. The extras, most of whom had hidden inside the vintage cars, climbed out and gathered in their places. Larry gave them a pep talk while also good-naturedly warning them not to look into the camera. If they did, he said, he was going to dock their pay. This was a laugh line, as their pay was minimal. Many came up and told me they were extras just for the honor of being in my movie. In fact, I was the one who was honored by their loyalty and hard work. Jake had a little speech to make and nailed it the first time. Then the cameras turned toward the crowd of extras. As they parted, Chris Cooper appeared. his expression that of a man who was doing his reluctant duty. This subtly changed to one of quiet interest as he was offered the firing box, with Jake saying, "This one's yours, Dad, if you want it." Over the next few hours, Joe shot the scene again and again. Each time, Chris put his arm around Jake's shoulders and the crowd reacted with awe as the huge Miss Riley flew aloft. Chris Owen got in the final line, and it was a good one. "Watch it go, Homer. This one's going for miles." I thought it was the pitch-perfect way to end the movie, but Joe had a surprise for me. After the Miss Riley scene, he would insert the dramatic rumbling launch of a space shuttle, followed by ancient 8mm film of each of the Rocket Boys, my parents, and Miss Riley. I can't watch that ending without tears in my eyes, no matter how many times I've seen it. Fans of the movie also tell me how much they love it when Chris Cooper puts his arm around Jake Gyllenhaal, and many a strong man has confessed to weeping during that scene. Maybe Joe and Lewis knew what they were doing after all. The shooting day ended, and the big tractor trailers holding all the lights and sound equipment and cameras rolled away. Since this was the last time I would be on location, I drove back to Petros, its streets now empty of actors, crews, and extras. The tipple set loomed, heralded by the arched Olga Coal Company sign. Someone had left a folding chair, so I sat down in it and absorbed for one last time all the work that had been done to recreate Coalwood. A dog barked in the distance, and overhead the stars blinked on, one by one. For just a moment I was back in Coalwood again. Back to the ancient place where once, as I described it in the final paragraph of the memoir, there were rockets that leapt into the air, propelled not by physics, but by the vibrant love of an honorable people, and the instruction of a dear teacher, and the dreams of boys. Glancing skyward, I did not see a space satellite streaking across the starry sky. That would have been a little too perfect. Instead, I simply rose from the chair and headed for my car, not bothering to look back. I was instead looking forward to what was going to happen next. Of course, what I thought was going to happen was nothing like what actually did. Chapter 10. Linda and I weren't in Tennessee for the end of the filming. If there was a wrap party, I wasn't aware of it, but I imagine there was. By then, I was deep into the final draft of a novel titled Back to the Moon and preparing for the publication of Rocket Boys. Word came that Life magazine was going to publish an excerpt of the memoir, and actor Beau Bridges had signed to narrate the audio version. International publishers in Great Britain, Spain, the Netherlands, Germany, Japan, Korea, Italy, France, China, and other countries were bidding for publishing rights. When Tom Spain faxed the Rocket Boys cover, I wasn't certain I liked it, and Linda unreservedly hated it. It consisted of a stylized picket fence, the stakes made to look somewhat like rockets, or perhaps the truncated stripes on a stylized American flag. My concern was the cover gave no hint what the story was within. When I told Tom I wanted a cover that showed some miners' kids holding a rocket with a mine tipple and mountains in the background, he said my concept was too literal. It would turn out that literal is sometimes good, especially when the book is something unique and difficult to describe in a few words. Tom asked me to list celebrities I thought might be interested in the book. The one that came immediately to mind was David Letterman. Long before I had even thought about writing Rocket Boys, I'd taught David to scuba dive during a weekend in New York. At the time, I had used my NASA acumen to build an underwater spacesuit to train students at space camp in Huntsville. When Dave's producers found out about it, they flew me up to New York to teach him how to scuba dive and wear the suit, the idea to do an all-underwater show. Although the show was never done, I figured Dave would remember who I was and might like what I'd written. In July, Linda and I were flown out to Los Angeles to see a cut of the film with Chuck and Joe. It was the first time I'd seen the movie from beginning to end, and I was surprised how well it moved. Joe and editor Robert Dalva had clearly done a great job, all the disjointed parts blending together perfectly. Joe's somber lighting effects, matching the actual sky for much of the shoot, had also proved to be perfect for the movie. There was also something else that was clearly established. This was Jake Gyllenhaal's movie. His performance was brilliant. When the lights came up, I was feeling pleased. A representative from Universal Studios stood up and asked the test audience for their reaction, and their comments showed they enthusiastically loved the movie. Then the Universal rep asked the audience if they liked the title. When the response was more or less a shrug, the questioner pressed until he got what I thought he wanted, that the title, Rocket Boys, wasn't the right title for this film. I got a sinking feeling in my stomach. Why an interest in a name change? Afterwards, with Chuck and Joe both basking in the glow of the pleased audience, I kept my peace about the title, even though I thought it would be a disaster if the book was called one thing and the movie another. When I next talked to Chuck, he gave it to me straight. Universal marketing people didn't like Rocket Boys, and were determined to change it for several good reasons. One of them was they felt my title was too similar to The Rocketeer, a previous Joe Johnston film. Another was that they were afraid there might be confusion with a silly 1997 movie titled Rocket Man. The third reason, and the one Chuck gave the most weight to, was Universal marketing executives thought the core audience for the film would be women over 30, and they were certain few in that demographic would want to go to a movie titled Rocket Boys. Although I understood the problem with the similar-sounding titles, I didn't believe the audience for our movie was going to be mostly women over 30. Although I lobbied Chuck and Joe to head it off, I soon realized they had no stake in protecting the title. When I told him about the possible name change, Mickey told me Universal held the cards, and if they wanted a change, it would be done. When I told Tom Spain, he was appalled. A couple of titles were floated past me. One was Hearts in the Sky, which made me want to throw up. When someone suggested Homer Hickam, I begged them not to do it. In my memoir, Homer Hickam was the father. It would be totally confusing. Eventually, a title was found that satisfied everyone involved except me. It was Joe who came up with it by putting Rocket Boys in his computer and tasking it to give him an anagram. An anagram is when the letters of words are rearranged to make other words, and the computer spat out the only anagram that made any sense. October Sky. This, as it happened, was the day Joe edited the scene in the movie where Homer looks up into the October sky and watches Sputnik fly over Colwood. As soon as he saw it, Joe thought to himself, this is way cosmic. Immediately he called Chuck, who agreed it was way cosmic indeed. Excited, they called me. When I heard the new title, I was somewhat less than thrilled, but Chuck ignored my negativity. Great, he said. We knew you'd love it. Then he and Joe hung up. All the misgivings I had about the movie came tumbling back. I called Mickey to complain, but he said he liked the title. They know what they're doing, he advised me for the umpteenth time. After the book was published, Joe would email me an explanation that further justified the change, saying when his sister saw Rocket Boys in the bookstore with its red, white, and blue star-spangled picket fence cover, she thought it was a book about military rockets. October Sky was the better title, he said, because it made people think about looking up. The poster Universal developed for the movie was also much closer to what I wanted for the book cover, with Jake, Homer, looking up at the moon and a mine tipple and mountains in the background. Rocket Boys was published on October 16, 1998, and I had my first radio interview the same morning. The interviewer's first question was, "So, Hiram, why did you write this book about John Glenn?" For a moment I froze. Not knowing my name didn't surprise me, but not being aware of the subject of the memoir did. I recovered as best I could. "I'm sure John Glenn will love the book," I said. "But this is the story of teenaged boys in the West Virginia coalfields who built rockets." The sound I got back from the interviewer was crickets, so I more or less interviewed myself until he pulled the plug. The next interviews were only a little better. Mostly my name was pronounced Hickman. But since none of the radio hosts had actually read the book, they instead asked questions about the space program, which did nothing to sell the book. When I read Delacorte's promotional materials sent to the stations, I saw it was mostly about me being a NASA engineer, and not much about the story of the boys and people of Colwood. It was almost as if my publisher lost its nerve at the last minute and decided to make Rocket Boys a space book, whether it was or not. There was even a reference in the copy about Senator John Glenn flying aboard the shuttle. It was no wonder the interviewers were confused. As book sales dribbled in, Tom called to report they were good but not great, and my book tour was being extended to 3 months, including a lot more radio and television. I hit the road again, and before long, sales for the book began to rise. Tom said it was probably because people were starting to talk about the book and recommending it to other readers. Independent booksellers were also enamored with it and were telling their customers that Rocket Boys was a great read. In London, where I went to push the book for the UK publisher Fourth Estate, I came down with a terrible case of laryngitis. Unfortunately, that was when David Letterman told the publisher that he'd read Rocket Boys, loved it, and wanted me on his show right away. Unhappily, my voice was gone, and it was impossible. Still, Rocket Boys was named by the New York Times as one of the notable books of 1998 and also climbed to the paper's extended bestseller list. The reports from bookstores countrywide was enthusiastic. The reviews on Amazon were consistently 5 stars. Progress was being made. Delacourt flew me and Linda to New York for the National Book Critics Circle Award, and Tom and other executives accompanied us to the Tishman Auditorium for the announcement. I sought out Sylvia Nasser, the author of A Beautiful Mind, the book Tom said was my main competition. Ironically, it was the story of John Nash, a man from the West Virginia coalfields, who grew up only 30 miles away from Colwood. Nash, suffering from schizophrenia and paranoia, had gone on to win the Nobel Prize for Economics. Although I hadn't read the book, everything I'd heard about it was good. I shook Nasser's hand and told her, with Tom standing beside me, "I hope you win. You deserve it." When the announcement came that A Beautiful Mind was the winner, Tom provided me with a wan smile and said, "Well, you got your wish, Homer." The movie apparently wasn't going to win any prizes either. Originally scheduled to come out in December to make it eligible for the 1998 Academy Awards, Universal instead pushed it back to February, traditionally a dump month for films. When I talked to Mickey about it, he said, "No matter when it comes out, it's still a great movie." This was little consolation, considering how hard everybody had worked on it. Then Tom called to tell me Delacourt had decided to bring Rocket Boys out as a mass-market paperback under the Dell label, retitled October Sky, to coincide with the movie release. I could tell by his tight voice that he was upset with this decision. "The title change is just the mass market," he reassured me. "We'll keep the hardcover with the old title, and later we'll bring out a trade paperback titled Rocket Boys 2. Everything seemed to be going wrong, but Linda told me to stop worrying because it was out of my hands. Happily, book sales rose as the Christmas season approached, and great reviews were still pouring in from all over the country. A lot of complimentary letters and email were also reaching me. Before long, we started talking about a website that we eventually developed for all my books, www.homerhickam.com. The Hollywood premiere of the movie was on my 56th birthday, February 19th, 1999. A limo picked me and Linda up at our hotel, and we rode with Jake, Naomi, and Mickey. Mickey looked over at me and said, "Savor this moment, Homer. It will never come again." In fact, I did savor it. Linda was dressed to the nines and looked stunning. Jake was so excited he could hardly sit still. We waited until he did his turn down the red carpet, then followed as cameras flashed and people cheered as if we were somebody important. The movie was shown to tremendous applause and a standing ovation. When the lights came on, I got my first indication that the movie was going to touch the hearts, minds, souls, and guts of a lot of people. At the party afterwards, Pete Conrad, the third man to walk on the moon, sought me out to tell me how much he'd loved the movie. It was an amazing moment. The second premiere was in Knoxville, close to the locations where October Sky was filmed. My mom and brother Jim were able to attend this one, along with all the surviving Rocket Boys. Nearly all the extras showed up as well, carrying with them souvenirs of the movie, including some of the rockets. How they got them, I have no idea, but I didn't ask any questions. Jake was there along with Scott Miles and, of course, Joe and Chuck. Of the two premieres, the one in Knoxville was a lot more fun. The extras in attendance were so excited about their movie. You could just feel their love during the screening. It was contagious. Finally, I got a chance to go on Letterman, this time to talk about both the book and the movie. Dave and I had a great time, and then he showed a clip of me teaching him to scuba dive rather than a clip of the movie. Universal didn't much like that, but it was Dave's show, and I didn't mind. In any case, it didn't much matter. Review after review proclaimed October Sky as a fresh and inspirational film, and probably as a result, book sales surged. Within a few days, the mass market was number one on the New York Times bestseller list. Tom and I were both thrilled by this because the movie had helped the book reach an audience it might never have found. Interestingly, despite the prodigious reviews, October Sky didn't fare so well at the box office. Although it had an initial surge of popularity, it quickly faded in U.S. theaters. This was alleviated somewhat when we traveled to Italy for the Venice Film Festival and then the London Film Festival. In both cases, the movie was met with critical success and standing ovations. In Venice, the audience even turned around to enthusiastically cheer Joe, Chuck, me, and Laura Dern. Laura was so excited by their reaction that she kissed my hand. No one was more surprised than me, but it was heartfelt, and I thought she had done a magnificent job as Miss Riley. In the final edit, nearly every change she had insisted upon to make her character stronger and closer to the real Miss Riley had ultimately been adopted. I was proud and happy for her. Linda and I also got to know Chris Cooper much better during our sojourn to Venice. He and his wife Marianne, also an accomplished actor, revealed to Linda and me that it was their first vacation together since their son Jesse had been born with cerebral palsy. We came to love them and their quiet courage in support of their son. We also got to have a lot of fun exploring Venice together. Venice was also our chance to get to know Chuck and Linda Gordon better. Chuck's brother Lawrence and his wife were also attending the festival. Although we were all busy giving interviews and otherwise interacting with the media and festival participants, we had one evening together at a nice cellar restaurant. Properly wined and dined, we talked about everything and nothing until Linda and I felt as if we'd known both sets of Gordons forever. They could not possibly have been more gracious and kind. Joe and Lisa Johnston were also with us. Lisa was and is a sweet woman, filled with pride for Joe's accomplishments, and it was wonderful to visit with her. The reception the Italians gave Joe's movie was clearly very pleasing to him. It was nice to see him relaxed and happy after the grueling days he'd spent making it. October Sky got a similar reception in London, the audience responding with endless applause that belied the usual English reserve. One of the best aspects of both the Venice and London film festivals was that Linda and I, because of scheduling necessities, got to fly back to the States aboard the Concorde twice. It was an amazing aircraft that allowed us to see the curvature of the Earth, something Sonny Hickam would have been astonished to see. And so was Homer Hickam, Jr., the grown-up who'd taken his place. There was one more gathering we would all have together, this time with writer Lewis Kollek in attendance. In May, Chuck called and asked us to come out to Los Angeles to attend the Humanitas Prize luncheon. This award was conceived by Elwood Kaiser, a Roman Catholic priest famous within the Hollywood community as Father Bud. His idea was to honor screenplay writers for scripts that best promoted human dignity, meaning, and freedom. Good Will Hunting had won the previous year. The Shawshank Redemption and Schindler's List were also winners. Chuck explained to me that it was a big deal in Hollywood for a writer to win it. I was pleased that Lewis was in the running, but I saw he was up against Saving Private Ryan, one of the most popular movies ever made. Also nominated was A Civil Action, a successful John Travolta vehicle based on a book that won the National Book Critics Circle Award. It was therefore all the more astonishing when the announcement came that Lewis Kollek for October Sky was the winner. Although I had doubted his original script and some of his interpretations of my characters, it was confirmation that Lewis was a great writer. As he rose to receive his prize, I embraced this truth. Linda and I flew home, pleased with how everything had turned out and ready to take on whatever came next. I sensed my great literary and movie adventure was essentially over. After all, The movie was out of the theaters, the book had receded from the New York Times bestseller lists, and I was now deep into my next book and looking forward to writing more. But were Rocket Boys and October Sky really over? What I didn't know, but nobody knew, was that there was very much yet to come. Chapter 11. There was a pause, almost as if everyone was taking a breath. After Back to the Moon, I got busy writing The Colwood Way, a Christmas story I'd pulled from the original memoir. I also had in mind to write historical fiction. During the research and writing of Torpedo Junction, some great stories had come to me about the people of the fabled Outer Banks of North Carolina. There was a good novel there just waiting to be written, I was certain of it. Then it began. The letters and emails, the interviews, the requests for appearances and speeches from every state and nearly every country around the world. Everyone, it seemed, had fallen in love with the real Rocket Boys, whether they knew us from my book or from the movie. Frank Wyman took me across New York to the offices of Greater Talent Network, a lecture agency, and signed me up. Before long, I was back on the road, this time making speeches and telling stories. No matter what I wanted to talk about, what people wanted to hear most were my tales of Colwood, my parents, and boyhood dreams. Happily, I discovered my West Virginia roots had provided me with the ability to tell a good story in front of a crowd. When people came to see me, I knew they thought I would be technical and dry, and were always surprised to find I soon had them laughing and sometimes crying. After all, the stories I had to tell had the bittersweet ending of my father and little Sonny together on that ancient slack dump. I often read from Rocket Boys of that moment, and there was rarely a dry eye in the house, including my own. Those times still live within me. In the epilogue of Rocket Boys, I wrote this. Sometimes now, I wake at night, thinking I have heard the sound of my father's footsteps on the stairs, or the shuffling boots and low murmur of the hoot owl shift going to work. In that half-world between sleep and wakefulness, I can almost hear the ringing of a hammer on steel and the dry hiss of the arc welder at the little machine shop by the tipple. But it is only a trick of my imagination. Nearly everything that I knew in Colwood is gone. Yet I believe, for those of us who keep it in our hearts, Colwood still lives. Even now, Colwood endures, and no one, nor careless industry or overzealous government, can ever completely destroy it. Not while we who once lived there may recall our life among its places, or especially remember rockets that once leapt into the air, propelled not by physics, but by the vibrant love of an honorable people, and the instruction of a dear teacher, and the dreams of boys. Gradually, we realized that Rocket Boys, or its mass-market paperback version retitled October Sky, was being taught in classrooms by both science and English literature teachers. When so many emails came in from students asking for detailed information about the book, Linda and I figured out they were asking for help with their homework. For assistance, we added resources to www.homerhickam.com for both teachers and students. A lot of the email was also about the movie, too. It was being shown in schools everywhere, not only in the USA, but across the world. I began to use the line, "Every substitute teacher in the world shows October Sky." I think it's nearly true. From our mail, it was clear that a lot of teachers were using both the book and movie. Some schools had Rocket Boys celebrations where the students dressed up like characters in the book. At one school where I visited, I was delighted to be met by a huddle of Dorothy Plunks and Valentines dressed in poodle skirts and sweaters. Awards began to roll in, so many I began to lose track, even including an honorary doctorate from West Virginia's Marshall University. Rocket Boys, October Sky also began to be picked by communities and libraries across the country as their annual read. So many of them picked the book, a search on the internet revealed that it was the most frequently selected book during the first decade of the 21st century, even ahead of To Kill a Mockingbird. Pretty soon the memoir was being hailed as a classic. I was savvy enough to know that writers who write classics are sometimes pigeonholed by that work forever, and that happened to me to an extent. Even though I was writing about one book a year, people who met me invariably said, "Oh, Mr. Hickam, I love your book." And I needed no explanation as to which book they were talking about. Of course, most writers would be delighted to write a book that is beloved by millions, and I am no exception. The popularity of the book and movie continues to grow. The film is shown regularly in classrooms and on network and cable television worldwide. I always know where it's being shown by the flood of email we receive from India, Brazil, Iraq, China, or wherever. Thousands of emails and letters from students determined to go into engineering and science stream into our home. They invariably tell me it's because of the inspiration they've received from the movie or the book. Others write to simply say thank you for a story that touched their hearts. When I made a speech at the U.S. Air Force Academy, a group of cadets sought me out to tell me they were there because of October Sky. I was thrilled then, and still am. One of the best things that happened because of the popularity of the book and the movie was the focus that turned on Little Colwood. After the mine closed in 1978, houses there were abandoned or torn down. The old school was burned to the ground. The company offices and machine shops were left to rot. And the people in the town found themselves mostly unemployed. With a new spirit provided by the story of their Rocket Boys, Colwood rallied and began to put on an annual October Sky Festival. For 13 years, the remaining Rocket Boys and I went to Colwood and there signed books all day, while people flocked from everywhere to celebrate our story and the history of the coalfields. When there were too few people left in Colwood to put the festival on, the city of Beckley, West Virginia, picked it up, renaming it the Rocket Boys Festival, www.rocketboysfestival.com. The other Rocket Boys and I continue to support it because it brings people to southern West Virginia to celebrate our coal mining heritage. Another marvelous result of the story's popularity was the creation of a Broadway-style musical based on the book. Titled Rocket Boys the Musical, it was co-written by me and Carl Anthony Trayman, with music and lyrics by Dan Trayman and Diana Belkowski. The musical has now settled into an annual staging at Theater West Virginia, and we hope it will eventually go to Broadway. After The Colwood Way, which climbed to the New York Times bestsellers list, Tom Spain left Delacorte and I lost my best friend within the Bantam Doubleday Dell BDD empire. Sky of Stone was my next memoir, and of the three memoirs I wrote, I thought it was the best written. Unfortunately, it was released immediately after the 9/11 attacks on New York and Washington and struggled to find its audience in the aftermath. Still, it has turned into one of those books with a long career of sales and affection. As soon as I got home from the Sky of Stone tour, Frank called to say that Health Communications, the company that publishes The Chicken Soup for the Soul books, wanted me to write a book to encourage the American people to go forward and overcome fear. The result was We Are Not Afraid, that told stories about how the people of Colwood overcame fear and the various disasters inevitable in a coal town. When Frank asked me what I wanted to write next, I told him my idea to write what would become The Keeper's Son, and we signed with Thomas Dunn of St. Martin's. The next three novels were my Josh Thurlow stories, which was then followed by The Dinosaur Hunter, a mystery set in the fossil grounds and badlands of Montana. Although none of these novels became huge bestsellers, they gathered a core of readers who looked forward to my work past Rocket Boys. Frank soon brought me together with another publisher, Thomas Nelson, which published Red Helmet, a novel of romance in the modern West Virginia coalfields, followed by the Helium 3 series set on the moon 120 years in the future that includes Crater, Crescent, and in 2014, Crater True Blood and the Lunar Rescue Company. After these novels, I am planning to write for William Morrow a humorous tale of my parents when they were young and carried Mom's pet alligator from the hills of West Virginia back to its swampy home in Florida. It will be different from anything I've written before, and that, for me, is one of its appeals. I love a good challenge. Chuck Gordon and Joe Johnston remain good friends, and we often talk or see each other. Mickey Freiberg continued working in Hollywood on my behalf to the day he died in 2012. Through his efforts, Back to the Moon was optioned several times by different producers and Sky of Stone by Hallmark. The Keeper's Son received an option, and there was a lot of interest in Red Helmet. Yet, for one reason or another, none of these books made it all the way to the coveted Hollywood green light. It reinforced all the more how special and miraculous the writing of Rocket Boys and the making of October Sky were. All that I can conclude is there was a greater force behind their success. That's why I wrote this in the conclusion of Sky of Stone. As for me, I hope to continue writing and entertaining my readers, and maybe even providing some occasional illumination on life as it was, is, or shall be. I am a lucky man, and I know it. The engineer of the universe has looked after this Coalwood boy, don't ask me why. The wheel of Jeremiah continues to turn with those great hands on it, shaping me, shaping us all. There are miracles everywhere, although sometimes they are concealed, not by God, but by our own eyes. All we need to do is look, and they will be seen.
This has been an Audible Inc. production of From Rocket Boys to October Sky, written by Homer Hickam, narrated by Joe Barrett. Producer Mike Charsick. Copyright 2013 by Homer Hickam. Production copyright 2013 by Audible Inc.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.